Okay, we are on lesson six, and we are talking with our first oracle. But before we get there, we need to review our visions and our messages so that we know what has preceded it and what's the foundation of it. So we're going to go quickly through this. Hopefully, I know some of you took back your chart and really studied it this week, which I love because I think it's really important for us to know that on your own. So I already have all of the vision visuals up there. Let's see how well we can do with what those visions actually represent. So we talked about the visions representing the kind of loyal king we have. So the very first thing we learn about our loyal king is this one, right? So what does that tell us? What kind of a king do we have?
A king who invites.
A king who invites. Okay, so we're going to start here. I'm going to take this one down when we get to this point. But we have a king who invites. And the invitation is a participation into his life rather than participation in our own picture, right? And that's a huge paradigm shift for us, to be invited into someone else's life rather than our own. But we get those invitations all the time, right? We get an invitation to participate in someone, whatever someone else is doing. Like, I don't know about you, but when I go to visit someone out of town, they always say, "What do you want to do?" And I always say, "I want to do what you do every day because I want to know your life." And that's where you learn more about somebody, which is also partly our question this morning, too, is I want to know you by participating in your life. That's the only way I'm really going to get to know you. So that's what God says, is participate in my life. Put down your picture and participate in mine. So that's the kind of king we have. So then we have the horses. What does it tell us about the kind of king we have? A king who pays attention. And why the horses? Because those are a patrol, right? Patrol that is looking to see what's going on with my people here. So a king who pays attention. Then we have the horns. What does that tell us about God?
A king who answers the
question. Okay, I only hear like three voices. I'd like to hear the rest. This is something you really do need to know. Not because, as in past times, I actually have a test at the end. I'm not going to have a test at the end. This is for your good so that you actually, day by day, have a place to go and figure out what's going on in your life and where's God. So a king who moves against our oppressors. Then we went to the tape measure. What does that tell us? A king who makes space to dwell with us. And how does he do that? Right, he reverses the order, which is usually the order that we usually live under is, I'm king, right? And he's going to reverse that. So all of these things, God is paying attention, God moving against our oppressors, God making space to dwell with us, all of those mean that we're going to have to be vulnerable, and it's not going to be fun, right? Because what he's doing is taking us out of kingship. Even Job said, God, stop paying so close attention to me. And that's how we are, right? If you're the only child left, if everyone goes to college, right? Don't pay attention to me. Don't pay so much attention to me. Like, I want some attention, but not so much. All of those things we're going to have to be vulnerable for. So when we get to the turban, what does it tell us about our king? Good. King who vulnerably serves us. And he does that by taking on the responsibility of our disloyalty so that we can actually participate in the new order. I cannot participate in the new order as long as I'm carrying around disloyalty. Right? I can't go into the ball pit if I still have my shoes on. I'm invited into the ball pit. I'm not saying you can't come. God says, I want you to participate in the ball pit, but you've got to take your shoes off. And so someone's going to hold those shoes for you, and that's going to be the high priest. So that's the vulnerable part, and this is where it switches, so that we can rightly rule, so that we can actually participate and invite our neighbors into life. That's where we go from there. We go all over here into the fifth vision. What does that tell us about the king?
The king breathes life.
So the king is empowered with the breath of life and gives us the breath of life, which is our superpower, right? We're able to give other people the breath of life, which is loyalty to the king because he's taking care of us. So we have this ability to give, which is funny because we always think we have to give them something else. But we have the best superpower there is, and that is the breath of life. How about the flying scroll? What did that tell us?
A king whose words
A king whose words cleans. So remember that the it goes in and exposes and it cleans. And it actually has to burn down the whole house because it doesn't want anything for us to support our lives on anything but the king and his loyalty, which has a lot to do with where we're going today. What is the basket?
A king
who covers and exiles evil. So this is that place where God says, this has to be done away with in your life, and I don't want you to go to that, so I'm going to take it away from you. But you can't resist that being taken away, right? There, nobody's grabbing onto the basket. That's going to come up a lot in from next week on. For 40 days, you should be thinking about that, right? Mm-hmm. You're saying to God, expose what is in my life that's wickedness. Expose what's in my life that is actually that I have more loyalty and love for than you. And then, after that 40 days, make sure I can't get to it again, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So this is really a beautiful picture of Lent coming up. And then the last one, what does that tell us about our king?
Who battles for us and gives us rest.
Yes, yeah, so all the battles, all of these, actually end up with Sabbath, right? Giving us rest, where God can be king, ruling and relating with us without obstacle, and we can then be image bearers, priests, and co-rulers. So that's the vision. After the vision, Zechariah comes out with four messages. Therefore, basically, it could say, therefore, since we have a God who is like this and loyal to us, how then should we respond? We should respond by testifying to the kind of king that we have. In the New Testament, they do a different thing, and they talk about people testifying to a loyal king by the picture of a bondservant. So lots of you know the picture of a bondservant, right, from the Old Testament. And the picture of a bondservant is someone who had been indentured but then is released, and he says, you know, my life is better being under a master than it is on my own. So I'm going to give myself to that master, and the master is going to mark me. So, and this truly happens. So people who had once been servants, freed, now say, I want to stay under you. I want to be able to serve you the rest of my life because life is so much better under you than it is on my own. And so they would pierce their ear with an awl, which means so people who have gauges now, that's what it looked like. And people would walk around with these, and the first thing people would say when they looked at a bondservant was, wow, that guy must have a great master because he gave his whole life to that master because life was better under that. That's the same picture that Zechariah is saying. Since we have such a loyal king, then live like this. So do you remember the first thing we're supposed to live like?
Repent. No, confess.
The true fast.
True fast.
Oh, I thought I had these all. Yes, a true fast. So practice a true fast. Not filling ourselves up. Remember we talked about not filling ourselves up with what we want, but then going practicing justice, which is filling the vulnerable up. I tried to come up with ways that this would be a little easier, but it's not working. So, the four messages. First two messages are practice a true fast, stop filling yourselves up, and then practice justice, which is to fill up the vulnerable. Give to those in need. Actually work to fill others up. So those were the two practices, and then there were two receptions. You were to receive something. And what were the things that we were supposed to receive?
Truth.
Truth, which meant?
Faithfulness. Continual openness.
Yeah, so a continual openness to God's faithful presence, right? That idea of, here we are, Lord, together, talking that conversation with God all the time. Mm-hmm. These are physical things that we do. These are things that we actually do. These are not like ideas. These are things we actually do, all four of these messages. So receiving truth means to continually be open to his loyal presence. And then what was the last thing we were supposed to receive?
Peace,
which is?
Continually open to God's restorative presence.
So a continually open to God's restorative presence. Remember, when I restore something, what does that look like? How many of you restore like furniture or... And how do you do that?
Strip down.
Yeah. So being being open to his restorative presence means letting him strip down, take off the old disloyalties, and put new coating on. All right. You know what? If somebody else would like to do that, that'd be great. So, practicing a true fast, practicing justice, receiving God's loyal presence, receiving truth, and receiving God's restorative presence, receiving peace, right? That's wholeness, right? Peace is always this term of wholeness, and I receive that only by being stripped down so that I can be brought into wholeness. Thanks, girls. Okay, so that's where we have been. Those are our visions and our messages. So today we start with the first oracle. Remember, there's two oracles. So we've had 8 visions, 4 messages, and now we have 2 oracles, always cut by half. And oracles, first of all, are completely different than visions or messages. Oracles always contain this double-edged sword. It is redemption and judgment. But we've already had pictures of this in the visions and in the messages, right? We always have to talk about the fact that redemption comes through judgment. So we can't go to the places where so many go is that there is no judgment, because there is no redemption without judgment. So there has to be both. And the oracles will always come at it that way. There's both redemption and judgment. When Zechariah begins his oracle, it's been 40 years since his messages, which means the temple has been done for at least 38 years. 38 years or more, somewhere around there, they have lived now with a restored temple, which means things should be going much better, right? We've got the temple and we should be faithful now. And yet here he has to come almost 40 years later with an oracle. An oracle is always kind of scary, right? Because it means, oh yes, God is still going to redeem. He's your covenant partner. He's going to redeem you, but there is going to be judgment. And if he has to come with an oracle, what does that tell you about where they're at?
Not there yet.
Not there yet, right? Not, in fact, not even, they haven't progressed any at all. They're still in the same places, even though they have the temple, which they've kept on saying, when we have the temple, we'll be great again, we'll be prosperous, and we can go back to living, just like before the exile, which is really what they do. They go back to living the same way. So that's kind of where we're at with oracles. So today's lesson is totally a history lesson, which is why I had the question, what of your personal history would help other people understand you better? Understand what you do, why you do the things you do. It was very interesting to go from group to group and listen. So I would say I know probably 3/4 of your stories. And I would have picked out something to say to the, I would have loved to say, no, you need to know this about this person, because that like opens everything up. So it was interesting to hear what you shared and what you didn't share. I realized that was a question that took a lot of courage and vulnerability, right? Because usually the things we really need to share about who we are is something that's a little hard to share, just like, oh yeah, I'm just going to, for the first thing I ever going to tell you is this is where I'm from. But it's very fun for me to sit in all those groups, because when you know lots of the history of somebody, you know where they're coming from, right? You know how they're viewing things. It helps you to understand why they do things the way they do and kind of what kind of reactions and responses they'll have, right? It really helps you to know these people much better. So for those of you who I've really sat down and talked with, like, I just have such a big picture of who you are. Now, I don't have the whole picture, right? Because I don't know all of you that into that depth. But when I hear your story, it makes you more than three-dimensional. Right? It allows me to participate in your life in some way, and I get to know you better. This is what's happening in Zechariah 9 through 14, is it becomes God displaying his story, right? History is his story, displaying who he is. He's been telling us, I'm a loyal king. I do all these things. And now I'm going to show you that I really physically do these things. This is not just a spiritual idea that we can set aside here and then live our physical life. All these things here, I'm going to show you that I'm actually doing them. I'm going to be doing them. I have been doing them. So depending on who's reading this, we get to see God's history and then understand what he's doing, which is why we need to know the visions before we get to the history, right? Because then we can interpret the history. Oh, I know what he's doing here. And then we can interpret why there needs to be judgment and interpret then the redemption that comes. So that's where we're going. It's packed. We are going verse by verse, so open your Bibles up as we get to, we start with Zechariah 9. There will be times that I'll just give you a whole section of verses, but times where I'm just going to have to give you verse by verse. History is going to always reveal God's sovereignty as king over the whole earth. So to separate history from God is to completely not understand history. But to understand history, and I'm talking real life history, is to understand God's sovereignty over everything that does. And to understand that his active movement is going on, that he's actually doing all of these things. He is always inviting all of humanity into participating into his history, to participate into his activities, to let him pay attention, to let him move against our oppressors, to let him expose and contain our own self-centered lifestyles, our kingships. But he's going to continue into those activities whether you participate or not. And so it seems, just if you know this is what he's doing, it seems reasonable to participate with him rather than let him keep going and you not participate and fight against all of those things. For those of you who do not participate in his activities, it's going to be devastating. Mm-hmm. For those of you who do participate, it's not going to be easy. But at the end, it actually will be refreshing and restorative. Think about, we struggle with judgment, right? I hear all the time, there are a couple, so I get lots of devotionals, and there are a couple that I've just wanted to rage against in the last couple weeks. Like, you are putting a wall against God having judgment. And you have to be careful about that. We're going to talk a lot about that. But think about a teacher, a math teacher, and he gives a test. And it comes back, and the teacher judges, right? He judges the right answers and the wrong answers. This is a good thing, right? Because let's say he didn't. He just said, like we want to believe, our God is a good God. He would never judge against somebody else. And the math teacher says, yeah, you know, I'm not going to judge these wrong answers here. And he gives back the test. He goes, good job. What happens then is the wrong answers get practiced over and over again, right? Because they haven't been corrected. They're not wrong. So then when this kid who's had all these wrong answers, pretending that they're good answers, he then decides he's going to go buy something. And because he's used wrong math, right, because he's been told this wrong math is right, he goes into the store and says, I want to buy this. And the clerk says, I'm sorry, you can't buy this. You don't have enough money. And he said, but I did the math, and I have the money. And the clerk says, I'm sorry, you don't have the money. Now what happens? Now there's going to be a fight, right? I'm going to insist that I have the money because I've been told all my life that I've done the math right. And therefore, you have to give it to me. And the clerk is like, but I can't give it to you because you don't have enough money. And so what has happened is it isn't just the non-judgment doesn't just affect the person who wasn't judged. It now affects other people, right? He has now brought in the clerk to have this separation of, I can't let you have this because you don't have the money. And now there's this tension, right? That can't happen in God's kingdom. God's kingdom is all about everyone flourishing together. Does that make sense to you? Judgment is necessary for God's kingdom to have everyone flourishing. So I say that because there's going to be a lot of judgment in here, and there's going to be a lot of judgment through history, and we have to take that seriously. And we'll talk about that even more as we get along. So we get to Zechariah 9, 1 through 7. I'm trying to think about how am I going to go through all of this. Somebody read 9, 1 through 7 for me.
I've got it.
Okay.
The oracle of the word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach, and Damascus is its resting place. For the Lord has an eye on mankind and on all the tribes of Israel, and on Hamath also, which borders on it, Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. Tyre has built herself a rampart, and has heaped up silver like dust, and fine gold like the mud of the streets. But behold, the Lord will strip her of her possessions, and strike down her power on the sea, and she shall be devoured by fire. Ashkelon shall see it and be afraid, Gaza too, and shall writhe in anguish, Ekron also, because its hopes are confounded. The king shall perish from Gaza, Ashkelon shall be uninhabited, a mixed people shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of Philistia. I will take away its blood from its mouth and its abominations from between its teeth. It too shall be a remnant for our God. It shall be like a clan in Judah, and Ekron shall be like the Jebusites.
Okay, so what we begin here is with a judgment of the nations first. So what we have here then is a list of nations that first of all have been enemies of Israel, but continue to be, and I'll tell you that in a minute. I just want to back up a minute to say, why will the nations get judged? Have they signed a covenant, as Israel did and as the church has? Have they entered into a covenant that says we agree to be your people? No, they haven't, right? But they actually have signed a covenant in a different way, and that is as rulers. So, and all rulers know this, they just don't know the specific God that they have done this with. They all know that their rulership, their ability to have to rule over other people has actually come from somewhere else, right? They didn't create it. They actually know that it came from God. And some of them are going to say, most of them are going to say from God's. And because of that, the one obligation they do have is to rule justly. In other words, to rule so that everyone flourishes. Now, we could go on a whole lesson about that. What does that look like for nations who aren't under Yahweh? They know what justice is, but how can they possibly administer justice when they don't know the God of justice? That's a whole other lesson. All that to say is the nations come under judgment in the past, in the present, and in the future, because they do have somewhat of a covenant with God who has put them in their position. And the rulers then represent the whole nations. And so the whole nations are still obligated to God for that one thing, and that is to rule justly. So, yes, the nations do come under judgment. Now, these, of course, are originally Israel's enemies. So they get a double judgment, right, for oppressing God's people. I had some really great historical stories to tell you about how you can rule justly without knowing God. I think I'll leave those for another day. But very cool if you like history. So every one of these countries that are going to have judgment against them, and remember, this hasn't happened yet. These are prophecies that says this is coming soon, in fact. Soon these areas are going to be judged. Right now, as Zechariah is speaking these, they're under Persia. Not only is Israel under Persia, but all of these countries are under Persia. They all belong to Persia. The Medo-Persian, right, where Cyrus started and Darius and Xerxes are ruling. Those are all under Persia. And what he's saying is, this is a north-south list. It goes from the north and it goes to the south. And it actually... What fell?
I just went on the slide.
Oh, no, one second. It's a north-south list of Israel's enemies, but it's also a north-south list of how these enemies are going to fall. One of the reasons they're going to fall, and the biggest reasons they're going to fall, he lists. right? And he lists every one of them as being prideful in some way. Prideful about their wisdom, prideful about their wealth, prideful about their own control and expectations, prideful about their purity, prideful about their strength. So it goes down one by one. All of that has to be judged in the present, because any country that is ruling with pride, in other words, saying, we are so wise that we deserve rule, what has that done? It says, we're king, right? And any country that's ruling that way is a danger to everybody else, right? Just like when you're king, you're a danger to everybody else, because it's your way or no way. And so these have to be judged on that basis as well. And so they will be judged going down exactly how they are. And what this does, if you know history, and this is one of the reasons you really need to know history, is being able to read this then. If you know history, this is exactly what happened when Alexander the Great, who was the head of Greece at the time, he was actually Macedonian, but he headed the Greek Empire. He began to conquer, starting with Damascus and going down. And this is actually a very accurate list of how Alexander the Great actually encountered these countries and conquered them. Now remember, they're all under Persia, so this is a judgment against Persia, right? And God is using Alexander the Great to conquer them. I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a timeline so that you understand. In other words, when we get to the oracles, we're back to the kaleidoscope idea. Remember the kaleidoscope idea? It jumps all over the place. And that's why I want to give you a timeline so you understand what Zechariah is talking about on each of those. So we have a timeline here, and here's Zechariah 9 through 14, right? 40 years after the temple has been done. So right now, in the very first part of the oracle, in 9, 1 through 7, he is saying that judgment is going to come against Persia, and it's coming in the form of someone who's going to conquer, just like this. And we know from history that Alexander did exactly that. So Alexander the Great does this, and he comes along at around 381 BC. So the oracle is first talking about here, Alexander. And Alexander's the head of Greece. Persia is in rule, but now Greece is beginning to conquer all of this. Somebody read. Somebody read just 8. Just verse 8.
But I will camp around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns, and no oppressor will pass over them anymore, for now I have seen with my eyes.
Okay. This actually also describes very accurately what happened when Alexander went down there. So you know, I should have put up a map of Israel. So you know this is from north all the way down south. He takes all these countries, but he gets, so before he goes into each of these countries, he sends envoys ahead of him, and he says, you're going to pay a tax to me. So you're going to have to do this because you're going to become mine, because I'm going to conquer you. He does this to Jerusalem as well, and he sends a convoy that, now, at that point, the high priest is the one person who kind of makes decisions for Jerusalem, and remember, they're still under Persia, right? So he's afraid. The high priest is afraid at this point. And this is historical. The high priest is afraid. I don't know if I should do this because I'm under Persia, and Persia might. So he's in between things. He doesn't know what to do. So he decides that he will go out of the city and meet Alexander outside of the city. If you know... history, you know that that movement is actually a movement to honor somebody who is a king. We could talk all about the places in Matthew where it says the people will go to meet Jesus, and people take that wrongly. It's actually going outside of the city to meet the king that you're bringing him in. So the high priest decides, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go and meet Alexander, and I'm also going to take all the priests with me, which means a lot of priests, right? Because it's not just the the people in line for the high priesthood is all the Levites. So this is a whole clan, and he's going to bring them all outside to meet Alexander. Alexander comes, and he sees the high priest. And first of all, he is pretty amazed that Jerusalem would send out this envoy. This is a huge honor for that to happen. But not only is this a huge honor, and Alexander is impressed. By the way, Alexander is around 28, 29 at the time. He's impressed, but here's another thing that's happened. This is all in secular historical documents. Alexander had a dream. And in that dream, he actually saw the very person who was high priest. And he saw a whole line of people in white robes, which is exactly what happens. And he takes this as a sign that he is not to destroy Jerusalem. And so he's destroying. He gets to Jerusalem. This happens. And he says, you're not going to have to pay the tax. And I'm going to leave you intact. And so then he bypasses and he goes down to Egypt. And he has a lot of victories down in Egypt. And then he comes back. And usually when warriors do that, they come down and then they come back. They make sure to get anything they missed, right? But he bypasses Jerusalem again. Because of this one event. What did verse 8 say? But I, God, will camp around my house in the midst of this destruction because of an army. This is the prophecy of what's happening with Alexander the Great in 331. So it's historically showing God to be paying attention, to be moving against oppressors, right? So do you see that if we know the visions, now we also know what God is doing in history. We should always be reading history against this. All history. Our history today, history in the future, and all history in the past. That's what is happening here. In 8b, it says, because of him who... and no oppressor will pass over them anymore. Is that true? Has any oppressor gone into Israel since then?
Yes.
Yes. So what we know by that is, this is going to happen in a little bit, but then farther down the road, even bigger. So remember, one of the things about prophecy is, it shows you what's going to happen in the near future, and then in the far future. And you always have to say, is this near future? Is this far future? We don't know. They don't know, right? They just know it's in the future because they can't see the next mountain. We know near future was Alexander the Great. Far future, not yet, right? Because there were their oppressors still going against Israel. That's where we end up with verse 8. Somebody read 9 through 17.
Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off, and he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, O prisoners who have the hope. This very day I am declaring that I will restore double to you. For I will bend Judah as my bow. I will fill the bow with Ephraim. I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and I will make you like a warrior's sword. Then the Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning, and the Lord God will blow the trumpet, and will march in the storm winds of the south. The Lord of hosts will defend them, and they will devour and trample on the sling stones, and they will drink and be boisterous as with wine, and they will be filled like a sacrificial basin, drenched like the corners of the altar. And the Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they are as the stones of a crown, sparkling in his land. For what comeliness and beauty will be theirs. Grain will make the young men flourish, and new wine the virgins.
Okay. So chapter 9 told us there's going to be judgment against the nations. First of all, judgment against whom? First. Persia. So chapter 9 is judgment against Persia. Chapter 10, or the second half of chapter 9, is judgment against Greece. Because that's the next place to come up, right? We've talked about that already in Zechariah. Zechariah already alluded to the fact that there are four horns, right? Remember, four horns. Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. All Zechariah is doing is giving them a little more information about what those horns are going to look like and how the judgment will come against each of those horns, how God will move against the oppressors. So we have now God judging Greece. He says, first, the king will be coming. You will have a king. At that point, he's saying, you can look for the king. He's coming soon. Not yet, but he's coming soon. And he's going to look different than you expect, right? So and what he's doing is he's contrasting everything that they saw Alexander to be. Alexander was dreaded and feared. He was horrific, which is also another huge thing that he bypassed Jerusalem. But he was feared, dreaded. They would shake when he would come. And so he's saying, when you look for your king, don't be looking for somebody like Alexander. So the whole time we're looking at 9 through 11, we're always going to be looking at the leaders. What are they reflective of? Are they reflective of God's type of rulership, or are they reflective of the world's type of rulership? And every time they're reflective of the world's type of rulership, they're going to be judged, right? Because that kind of rulership cannot enter the kingdom of God. And so he says, look at Alexander. Does he fit this bill? Because this is what my king will look like. And what does his king look like? He's going to be just. He's going to instill right order by judging wrong order. He's going to be endowed with salvation. Now remember, for the Jews, what that meant is salvation meant that they would have their own king who represented God, and that they would be able to live well as the people of God. That doesn't happen under Alexander, and you'll see in a minute how that does not happen. Alexander seemed to have left them on their own as if they could rule themselves, but Alexander only lives to the age 33. And when Alexander dies at the age of 33, his kingdom gets split into four sections. Do anybody know all this history? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yep. Great.
This is like really, really, really important history for us to know, because it helps us to understand what's going on, not just here, but when we read Jesus' story. Anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute. So he does. It seems like he's leaving them alone, but he doesn't. You'll see that in a minute, what happens with them. The king is also going to look. He's going to be humble. In other words, he's going to be poor or afflicted. Those are the same words. He has nothing to prop himself up with. Alexander doesn't look humble. In fact, Alexander was known as very arrogant. All of the rulers that we will talk about don't look like they're humble. And then it says, of course, and we have this beautiful picture of what? He's mounted on a donkey, a colt of a donkey. What does that remind you of?
Jesus.
Right. In Matthew 21, we know that Jesus actually fulfills that, right? Yes. So here is Israel listening to this and going, is that the kind of king we're going to have? Because that's what they're thinking, right? Because that's the only kind of king they know. And then Zechariah tells them, don't look for that kind of king. Look for a king who's humble. Look for a king who's just. And just always is going to look toward the vulnerable. So it shouldn't have been no surprise to them when Jesus is eating with tax collectors and sinners. He's looking toward the vulnerable. He's humble. He's endowed with salvation. He's trying to give them recognition of being loyal to God. He's then mounted on a donkey, which means for them that he's going to be coming not as a warrior, but as one who actually bears a burden. right? Because that's what a donkey does. It bears burdens. It bears the everyday life burdens. That's what a donkey was used for. And so it switches the picture of what they expect of their king. But he tells them, look for this. Look for this, because you're going to start getting people that are going to look like kings. Don't take the world's idea of a king. That's not what I want you to look for. I want you to look for this kind of a king. He will dispense with the tools of war. He will get rid of chariot and horses and bows. His means of peace will not be by the means of war, nor will it be only for Jerusalem, but for the peace of all the nations. So Gentiles is what he's saying. So of course, if we're thinking about, was there somebody in history that didn't look like a warrior king, but actually came and did all these things, and actually used not the means of violence, but instead absorb the means of violence. Do we know someone who did that?
Other than Jesus?
No, not other than Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah.
They certainly didn't know anybody, right?
There's such a contrast, and that's what God is saying. It shouldn't be hard for you to recognize, because there's going to be such a contrast. You're not looking for the type of king that you think you want. It's going to be a different type of king. And so historically, we know that in 33 AD, there was a man who actually absorbed violence rather than fighting, right? He absorbed all of those things into himself. We talked about what a high priest does, right? He absorbs, he eats all that disloyalty rather than fighting back. And so we have Jesus portrayed here well. But it then goes on to say his dominion is going to be over the whole world. I just want to catch you on this. Verse 10, the last verse 10, and his dominion will be from sea to sea. Here's an interesting American fact I bet you don't know. That verse is on the United States coat of arms. Mm-hmm. We embrace that, or we did.
Mm-hmm. Manifest destiny.
Exactly, mm-hmm. That God will be king over the whole world.
Make me think of that, from sea to side, shining sea.
And that's where it comes from.
Okay.
So we have a history where we said we want to be loyal to our king, which is helpful for us to know that that's our history and to be able to articulate that as well. So historically, has that happened yet? Is Jesus king from sea to sea? Physically, right now? No. So we know that this is a mixture of Jesus in 33 AD, but also in the future, right? And that's what's going to happen with these. This is sheer apocalyptic prophecy. So it's telling you what's going to happen in the future, and it's mixed between near future and far future. Okay. Haven't lost anybody yet, right? You know where we are historically. So the prophecy so far has talked about Alexander. But it's also talked about Jesus, right? So far, that's what the oracle has talked about. Judgment against the nation of Greece, or Persia, when we get to Greece. And now we're going to have judgment against Greece. So, it talks about in 11 through 17, this idea that because Israel's in covenant with God, that God is actually going to give them victory over. And it names right there, verse 13, who are they going to have victory over?
Greece.
Mm-hmm. Here's the history behind that. I think most of you know this part of the history. So when Alexander died at 33, unexpectedly, he was considered the greatest military general mm-hmm. of all history. So I think he was 26 or 27 when he started, and 33 when he died. When he died, he had no succession plan in place. Well, why would you at 33, right? So the kingdoms, and by this time, Greece is everywhere. The kingdom gets divided between his four generals. His four generals are Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Cassander takes over Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus takes over Turkey. Seleucus takes over Iraq, Iran, and Syria. and Ptolemy takes over Egypt. So that's now, that's the Grecian kingdom, right? Four generals, they're all Grecian. So Greece is in control, but they're administered by four different generals. Seleucus, up in Syria, so he establishes himself in Syria, but he's over Syria, Iraq, and Iran. He establishes himself there. He is especially ambitious, and he really wants to take over Egypt, where Ptolemy is the leader there. In doing so, of course, he's going to have to go through Israel. And so he goes through Israel, and he actually takes over Jerusalem. Now, remember, Alexander had left it on its own, but very soon afterwards, Seleucus comes down and actually takes over Jerusalem. And he assigns Jerusalem a king. All the kings from here on in are not like emperors until we get into Rome. So there's lots of little kings within the kingdom. And he says, okay, I'm gonna assign this Jerusalem and Judea a king, so I can go and finish Ptolemy. The king's name is Antiochus IV. Anybody hear that guy? Mm-hmm. Otherwise known, he gave himself this name, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he becomes the administrator of Judea. In Judea, because Seleucid loses to Ptolemy, he gets very upset, and so he decides to take it out on Jerusalem. And so through Antiochus, he starts making all these decrees that the Jews cannot practice their own religion anymore. So they are not allowed to walk around or own any Torah manuscripts. They are not allowed to worship their God in their temple. In fact, what Antiochus does is he makes sure that the temple is... the Holy of Holies is swiped out, and he puts in a statue of Zeus, which is the god that they are, the god of war, right? And he tells, he goes to a small town, and he tells Mattathias, the priest, who's the high priest at the time, you are going to sacrifice a pig on the altar. And Mattathias says, no, absolutely not. I will not do that, because that would be a desecration. But another priest says, I'll do it, right? Think about this in real time. You've got a ruler that's ruling you, and so there are people, I don't care where you're at or how much your convictions are, you get scared. I'll do it. I'll go sacrifice a pig. Mattathias can't stand it, and he kills the priest. Now we have a revolt. People against people, right? But a major revolt against Greece, because Greece has completely told them they cannot worship their God. And so they begin what's called the Maccabean Revolt. This is all intertestamental time, right? And they begin the Maccabean Revolt. It's called that because it's the family of the Maccabees, which the high priest was from. And his son, Judah Maccabea, is the one who actually heads the revolt. And they begin to fight against Greece, also against their own people.
But are these the people you told us about in the Apocrypha that kind of make themselves king, yep, but they aren't of the Jewish,
yep,
line?
This is the Maccabees.
Yep.
So they fight against Greece. This is what 11 through 17 are talking about, is the revolt, the Maccabean revolt. It says in 11 through 17 that the Lord saves them on that day. And because he saves them, because they actually win, the first and only time Israel in ancient history actually won against an oppressor by themselves. They win against him. The Lord saves them on that day. And because of that, they are able to clean out the temple out of the desecration, because there are dead bodies everywhere, all over the temple. They clean them out. And they rededicate the temple. And for the rededication, they realize they only have enough oil for one night. And yet they want to have a celebration that's longer than that. But they go ahead and use that. Oh, and there's like so many little cute things that happen. I won't tell them all. They light the the menorah, and this they had to refashion menorah because the menorah had been melted down, so they have to refashion one. So they have a new one. I'm not sure if that's when the menorah became. I think that's when the menorah became eight instead of or nine instead of seven branches. So they refashion it, and the oil lasts for 8 days. And so they consider that a miracle from God that that lasts 8 days, and God is blessing them for re-cleaning out the temple. So many things I want to talk about there. They call it the Festival of Lights. Not till later is it called, what? Hanukkah, later on. But they decide that they are actually going to institute this as another holiday, as another holy day. Now, remember, they have holy days that have been commanded by God. The Festival of Lights has not been commanded by God. But they're trying to memorialize what has happened here. So let me tell you just a little bit about what's going on and what goes on in Israel during that time. One of the ways that Judah Maccabee was able to defeat Greece at this point, because remember, they're small, is that he actually goes and makes an alliance with Rome. Rome is an up-and-coming power, and Judah Maccabee makes an alliance with Rome. Now, you need to know that because it completely skews our picture of Hanukkah, what they're celebrating, and what they do, and what happens to Israel. So, once the Maccabean revolt is done, Israel gets to rule themselves for 80 years. And the Maccabean family decides, now they are Levites, they are not Aaronites though. So they're not in line for the high priest role, they're Levites, they're serving in the temple. But the Maccabean family decides, we've done this, and we have the support of Rome, so we have money, we're going to make ourselves the high priests. So the Maccabean family does that, and they make their line the high priest. Not only do they claim the high priest status, but they also decide they're going to claim the kingship status. And so they decide they're going to be both. They didn't call themselves kings, but they created a dynasty. And the dynasty is called the Hasmonean dynasty. That was actually their last name. Maccabee means hammer. That's just a nickname that Judah Maccabee took on. Toward the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, so for 80 years, right, we have this family ruling both as high priest and king in Israel. Toward the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, there's two brothers, and they can't decide which one should be king. And so they ask Rome to mediate. Think about this. What has God said all along? Who are they to be loyal to?
To God
alone. No other rulers. And yet they have asked. Now they have, Rome has helped them defeat Greece, and now Rome is going to say which ones shall be king. So at that point, 63 BC, we have Rome's military leader, Pompey, come and says, great, I'm taking over. You can't decide, I'm going to take over. And he moves his army in. This is the time when Israel is finally occupied with an army. When we go into the New Testament and we see that there is Roman soldiers everywhere, comes from this point, where they asked Rome to mediate. They asked Rome to come in. That's why Rome is there. So Pompey comes in. The two brothers are still arguing. One of the brothers' advisors, one of the brothers' advisors actually ends up rescuing one of the Caesars. So Caesar at this point is fighting now in Egypt, and the advisor of one of the brothers, I'm not going to give you all the names because it'll just confuse you, the advisor, Antipater, goes and rescues Caesar. And now it's like, one of these two brothers? Yeah, maybe not. Maybe this advisor should be king. And so that advisor becomes administrator, Antipater, and his line is now the rest of the Hasmonean which actually begins the Herodian dynasty, because his son's name is Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the king when Jesus is born. But there's two Herods, right? Same in the same family. That's how all of that began, because they invited Rome in. They relied on Rome. And Rome comes in. Rome makes the decisions about who's going to be the head there. And all from them saying, we're king, we're going to make our Hasmonean dynasty. And the Hasmonean dynasty, when do I tell you all this? I'll wait for that. So here's a couple of things we need to know about the Festival of Lights. When they rededicate, because of the temple miracle, cleaning it out, they have now rededicated a temple, and they're celebrating a temple where God's presence has never and will never be. Remember, it left in Ezekiel, right? It left the Solomon's temple, and God's presence never came back. The fire and the cloud never came back to this temple, ever. They're celebrating a temple that houses a priesthood and a kingship that is not in line with God's choice. They're celebrating a temple structure that supports a leadership that was bought and fought for in alliance with Rome rather than received from God. And they institute a holy day, a festival of lights, that mimics a commanded holy day. And that holy day is the Festival of Booths, which actually was a festival of lights. We'll talk about Festival of Booths when it comes, because it's actually coming. What you see here is Israel being the tool of God to judge Greece and then taking it for their own. We're king. We get to decide what to do. And they actually prop up an imposter temple. Under Hasmonean rule, what do you think their devotion to God looks like? If this is the leadership, if the rule has come by being bought and being fought for, does leadership affect how the rest of the world, how the rest of their, yes. Absolutely. So here's the interesting thing. And you start digging and you find all sorts of things. Religious orthodoxy declined severely during the Hasmonean dynasty. People weren't doing, they weren't sacrificing, they weren't living lives loyal to God. It completely declined. There, so much so that they decided they were going to have to force conversions. And so they went down to Idumea, which is farther down, and they forced conversions. You're going to be Jewish. And so they forced all of Idumea to be Jewish, which is, if you know anything about the rulers that were under, that were in Jesus' time, they were all from Idumea. They were all converted Jews, which is why they're so not Jewish. So that comes. That eventually brings the Herodian line, which comes from the Idumea line. So all of that makes space then, of course, when Jesus comes to say, this temple, this is an imposter temple. I'm giving you the real temple. Do you see that? It completely colors when Jesus talks about himself as the temple, because this temple has never had God's presence. And it has been dedicated to man's power. It has been dedicated to us deciding what happens and not allowing God to give them that.
So I'm sorry, the Idumeans, am I saying that right?
Hasmoneans, yeah.
Are they Gentiles that have been converted to Judaism?
Yep.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah.
And the Jews were okay with that?
They're the ones that did it.
They did it because they were losing any real, they were losing people, let's say it this way, they were losing people going to church, going to the temple. They needed to convert. Which Christianity did that, right, in the Crusades.
Mm-hmm. But so I'm just curious. So do you think they looked at them as equals once they did that?
That's very interesting. they, that was hard for them, right? They already had this, this background about Samaritans, right? And yet, yeah, so they had, if they had converted to Judaism, they were considered a Jew. They were fine with people converting to Judaism. The odd thing is, it was forced, right? Which, what has God always said about, I'm going to invite you, I will never force you.
Yeah.
So we have this, once I'm not vulnerable to this, I'm going to have wrong ruling, right? And I'm going to rule in different ways. That's what 11 through 17 is about. Do you understand now, knowing history, why knowing history helps you read scripture?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
Absolutely helps reading scripture. All of these things act as little pieces to what will happen in the final battle. So remember, God always says, small beginnings. I'm going to start small, and I'm going to grow it. It's going to be bigger. It's not going to look like this. It's going to look like this and get bigger. So each of these pieces are pieces that we will see again, just in bigger ways, and then again in bigger ways. So we're going to see nations being judged, Israel being judged, and they'll be judged again, but in bigger ways as we go down there. So far we have the oracle talking about Persia being judged by Greece. We talked about Jesus, and now we've talked about Greece being judged by Israel. And that's where the Hasmoneans come into rule, the Maccabeans. So that's where we've talked so far. Redemption or judgment of Persia and judgment of Greece. Chapter 10. Chapter 10 now flips, right? We're in this kaleidoscope, and we're going to talk now about the redemption of Israel. So, somebody read. Let me see. I don't think I want to read this whole chapter. It's long. Read 10 through 4. 1 through 4, sorry. 10, 1 through 4.
Ask rain from the Lord at the time of a spring rain. The Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. For the teraphim speak inequity, and the diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted because there is no shepherd. My anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats. For the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic horse in battle. From them will come the cornerstone, from them the tent peg, from them the bow of the battle, from them every ruler, all of them together.
So here's an idea of, okay, Israel, you have been my instrument. That's how I'm going to begin to redeem you. But your redemption is going to come from you recognizing me as provider. That's when your redemption is going to come. So ask for rain. Why does he say that? Because when I ask, I recognize that I can't supply bringing the kingdom in on my own. When Israel finally comes to the realization that they are not going to be able to bring the kingdom on their own, which is what they tried to do with the Maccabees, right? They tried to bring God's kingdom on their own. It didn't work. As he's saying, it's not going to work. You're going to do this, but it's not going to work. When you finally actually get rid of your delusions and you begin to ask me for rain, and why he talks about rain is because that is, for an ancient Near Eastern person, rain is the one thing that brings life, right? That's the physical thing that brings life. It allows vegetation to sprout and then things to grow. When you do that, that is when we will know that your loyalty has returned to God. In verse 2, it talks about God being angry. God being angry, first of all, about them having teraphims and diviners. Teraphims are household gods. So he's actually talking about, I always think about Gladiator. Anybody see the movie Gladiator?
Yeah.
Do you remember when the gladiator goes home, and he goes home and he has these little tiny idols that he puts in his wall? Mm-hmm. Those are teraphim. It's So if you want to know what a teraphim looks like, that's what it is. So he says, in the past, you were idolatrous, and you actually had idols in your homes. We know that. Remember Judges? We have the high priest, or the priest there, having his own idols. And you had diviners, all of that. When you came back from exile because of that, you didn't go back into idolatry, but instead, you followed false shepherds, false leaders. And I'm angry with those leaders because they led you as if they weren't leading you at all. You were wandering as if you had no leader. You had leaders, but they were false shepherds. They were foolish shepherds. They were poor shepherds because they didn't lead you into loyalty to God. So my anger is kindled against them, he says in 3. And I will punish the male goats. That's the leaders, the of the flock. And I will eventually make you again my instrument. He's made, they're going to be instruments against Greece, but I'm going to make you my instrument again. And I will make you my instrument first. Somebody read verse 4. Okay, he says, this is how I'm going to purge you. I'm going to purge you through this. And there will be one person, they already know that God has talked about somebody he's going to send, right? This is more description about the one he's going to send. He will be a cornerstone. We talked about cornerstone before being keystone. This is actually a different word, and this actually is the word for cornerstone. Unfortunately, it's sad that they would use cornerstone for both. This is actually a cornerstone, a foundation stone. This one I send to purge you will actually be a cornerstone. It'll be the one who will be the foundation upon which the kingdom of God is built. He will also be like a tent peg. And a tent peg is not the pegs that are on the outside, you know, that you hold up the things. When he talks about tent peg, it's actually the middle pole and a nail that goes through the middle pole. What that was used for in ancient times, remember, they live in tents. This is their home. And the only place that they can actually hang the valuables is on that one tent peg. And so that tent peg had a nail through it, and on that they hung all their valuables. So if they had art or if they had gold, it was hung on that tent peg. So this is a place that their everything valuable would be hung on that. So this one cent is going to have the value of the kingdom hung on him. He will be a bow of battle. He'll be the one who shoots the fateful arrow that destroys disorder. And he will be, every ruler will be consolidated and concentrated in him. Obviously, as New Testament Christians, we understand that they're talking about Christ here. That this is this is what the one that's going to purge you is going to look like. But as that will happen in 33 AD, then it goes on to say, but you're still going to need to be purged. After that purging, you'll be strengthened, but you're going to first be scattered and regathered. So I know, this is again kaleidoscope. So it goes back and forth between, you're going to need to be purged. There's going to be one who's going to come who's going to purge you. You're not going to accept that purging, so you're going to have to be scattered and then regathered so that you do eventually look to that one and say, oh, we made a mistake. Okay, so that's what's happening in 10 here. Historically, we're talking about Jesus 33 AD, but we're also talking about Jesus in the second coming, because that only then will they recognize, oh, Jesus was the cornerstone, he was the tent peg, he was the bow, he was the ruler. And we know that because in the rest of 10, it talks about you're going to be strengthened, Judah and Joseph, that's north and south. You're going to be strengthened to be my people again, but only after you've been scattered and then regathered. So after the purging, 4 through 7, the purging will happen because of the Lord's presence in this one person. And as one nation, strengthen Judah, save Joseph, because of the Lord's compassion, not because you figured it all out. So historically, that hasn't happened yet, right? Israel has not recognized the tent peg. They have not recognized the cornerstone. But this, it says you'll have to be scattered and regathered in 8 through 12. It says the Lord will gather them again. They will remember the Lord from far countries. This is not the same as exile, as much as scattering, because they aren't going to one country. They're going to all over the world. And they will multiply in the land when they come back until there isn't room enough. The one who comes will recapitulate Exodus. He'll go through much distress, and this is verse 11. He will pass through the sea of distress, strike the waves in the sea. He will do all that in order to regather you so that you will finally walk and be strengthened in the Lord. Now we know that that regathering, has it happened yet? Okay, let's go back to, we haven't talked about Rome yet, but this is where Zechariah goes first. He says, you're going to be scattered. So we're going to talk about Rome in a minute. Rome obviously comes on the scene. They take over. We know that that's who's taken over in Jesus' time. After Rome goes into Jerusalem, one of Rome's emperors is named Hadrian. You ever hear of Hadrian? Mm-hmm. Hadrian comes in, and he actually, after the destruction of the temple, he actually comes in and actually destroys all of Israel. He flattens it. He denudes the whole landscape, which is why we find Israel now as it is. It's always been desert, but it's not flourishing, right? Mm-hmm. North part, yes, not the south part. That all came from Hadrian. And when Hadrian did that, he actually decided we're getting rid of the Jews. And he told the Jews they could no longer live there. And he said, get out. I don't care where you go, just go. And in the midst of him doing that, of course, they scatter everywhere, right? This isn't an exile. This is, they can't live here, so now they have to go to other places. This is in 135. When he does that, he also says there will no longer be an Israel. And this is the point that he says, this is not Israel, this is Palestine. And he changes Israel to Palestine, and he says, there is no longer Israel. So from 135 until some of our lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's no Israel. And all of the Jews are scattered. Now, after 100 years, Jews are allowed to come back. Not many do. In 1920s, now we're skipping all the way into the 1920s, and the ruling empire at that time, anybody know who's the ruling empire in the 1920s? Who?
That's the Persian Empire, isn't it?
Yep, British Empire. So the British Empire, they're the one who makes decisions on everything. And they actually asked the League of Nations at that time, not the UN. League of Nations comes to, and they decide on a mandate which says, Britain, you're going to decide what happens to all these areas that are kind of desolated right now. And the British mandate says, we will take this one area in the Transjordan and we're going to give it to the Jews because no one wants the Jews anymore. This is World War I. We're going to say this land can be for the Jews. And so the British mandate said Jews can go live in that area, which is what Israel was, right? They can go and live in that area. The day before the mandate would run out, so the mandate ran from 1923 to 1948. The day before it was going to run out, and now there was no protection of the British Empire, of the Jews being able to live there, Ben-Gurion, who became prime minister, who was not then a general, decided they were going to revolt and they were going to declare independence. And they were going to say, this is our land. This is Israel. It was still Palestine then. And so in 1948, from 1948 to 1949, we have the first Israeli war. And they win. And Israel declares in 1948 that Israel is a state and that it is the Jewish state. So that happens in 1948, guys. That's very recent, right? Very recent. And so Israel now that Israel is a state, what happens to the Jews around the world?
They start coming back.
They start coming back. They start regathering. Even to this day, a year ago, 27,000 Jews returned to Israel to become Israeli citizens.
Really? Wow.
Yes. That's, it continues so many, more and more every year. What's happening? Read scripture. Scripture said, I will scatter you, Hadrian, and I will regather you.
They keep reducing the amount of area. I mean, at first it was huge. It included Jordan and several other places, and they keep whacking it off and whacking it off and whacking it off. Mm-hmm.
Right. And they're, of course,
still want to whack it off.
But remember, what did he also say? There are going to be so many people that I regather that you won't all fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And so we have this going on today. This is happening today as we look at that. I mean, again, we could do a whole lesson on the repatriation of Israel. That's 10. So we have 9, judgment against Persia, and then judgment against Greece by Israel, right? We have Rome taking over in 63 BC. Zechariah doesn't touch when Rome takes over yet. But we know that Rome is in the midst of, they are the ones who are in rule when Jesus is born and when he dies. What we have in 11 then is now judgment of Israel. So we've had judgment of the nations, we've had redemption of Israel, but remember these are all pictures in the forefront. And now 11, we have judgment of Israel. And now we actually get a picture of Rome. So, somebody read 11, 1 through 3.
Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined.
If you're reading carefully, what you should go is, boy, that kind of sounds like 9, 1 through 8. It sounds like a north-south devastation, but it's no longer Israel's enemies. It's Israel land. It's land of Israel. So Lebanon belonged to Israel at that time during the Roman Empire. We see this. It looks like Israel itself is going to be devastated, just like the nations were going to be devastated. So we know right away this is a judgment against Israel. And we have the same idea. What's being judged about Israel? Look at what's being judged. What's taken down? Their cedars, the oaks, and the pride of Judah. I mean, it says it right there. These are the things they were prideful of. First of all, when you say cedars of Lebanon, what's the first thing you think of?
The temple.
The temple. Yep. So we're going, oh, their pride is in, right? All from the beginning, if we have the temple, we're great. Their pride is in the temple. The oaks of Bashan. Haggai has just told them 40 years ago, build up, go to the mountains and get the wood. That's the oaks of Bashan, and build the temple. And then we have the pride of Jordan. So Jordan used to be, so if any of you have been to the Jordan, you know the Jordan right now is a small river and it's got brush around it. It used to have a jungle around it. And that's what he's talking about. That gets devastated. Everything gets cut down. The cypresses, the oaks, and it's north to south, and the jungle gets taken down. And then it says the shepherds wail at this because their glory is ruined. What did the shepherds have their pride in? The land and the temple. And who are the shepherds? The shepherds are the leaders. And who are the leaders of Israel? The priests, the scribes, the Pharisees. These are the shepherds that we're talking about here. And they're upset because, this again will be in the future, when Israel gets devastated. When does that happen? Now we get to talk about Rome. So remember, back in the Maccabean time, they had already sold themselves to Rome, right? They had already said, Rome was not the power yet, Greece was. But they said, Rome, come and help us. Come and help us defeat Greece. And then Rome, come and help us decide on our own leadership. I mean, they sold themselves to Rome already. And so even though they were independent, the only time Israel's independent under themselves for 80 years under Maccabean revolt, Rome, in the meantime, had conquered all of Greece, right? And so we have the Battle of Corinth in 63 BC is the official, Greece is gone, now it's Rome. And that's when the Roman Empire begins. I'm simplifying all of this, so there's lots and lots going in here. Remember that that Israel at the time, even when they're ruling themselves, really already granted Rome the ability to rule them, right? Telling them who gets to be leading, telling them what to do. And of course, this is the scene that we have when Jesus comes on the scene, right? This is the context. We have a country who had already sold their leadership to Rome, and now Rome was really leading it. But how are the priests, in the time of Jesus, the priests and the Sadducees and all that, where was their power derived from? Was it derived because God had anointed them and told them, you are going to be the priests? And where did it come from? From Rome. So when we see the priests and the Sadducees in Jesus' time, they're all loyal to Rome. That's who's keeping them in their positions. They pay taxes to Rome. They are there and have power in Israel because of Rome. Now, that colors how they look at Jesus, right? Here's someone who's saying, I'm king. We can't have that because he's a humble king. He's not going to say, just give me money and I'll make sure that you stay in these positions, right? No, they got to protect what they have. And that means they got to choose, right? And this is the whole point of Zechariah 9 through 11. Careful who you choose as your leaders. Is God are you loyal to God? Or are you loyal to someone who's going to give you and prop up the positions you want? That's where all of the leaders are when Jesus comes on the scene. They give their full allegiance in 33 AD, right? They had this secret allegiance, but in 33 AD, they're called out. Where's your allegiance, right? And who calls them out on that? In 33 AD, who says to them, do you want your king? Pilate. Pilate says, here's your king. And what do they say? Not our king. We have only one king, and he is?
Caesar.
That's not new. It always has been. Now it's just been exposed. And remember, it's the leaders who call for the crucifixion of Christ. It's the leaders who say, we have only one king, but Caesar. Why? Because Caesar is assuring our positions. Caesar is assuring our false imposters' position. He's ensuring our false and imposter temple. And this one who is claiming to be the king of the Jews, he's also claiming to be the real temple. Do you see that? Do you see how different it looks now when you look at history to now look what's going on in Jesus' time? In 33, we know that happens. In 66, so 30 years later, they've completely sold themselves to Rome, and they realize, wow, this is getting tight. Rome is really trying to control us more. We don't like them, and they're not liking us. And so they begin to revolt again, like they did with Greece, right? We don't like this bondage anymore. We're going to revolt. And so Rome sends a general named Titus. And Titus comes to quell the revolt in 66 AD. He was ruthless. And he killed over 1 million Jews.
Wow.
1 million. Think about that. In that little area, 1 million Jews. But here's the worst part. He killed 1 million Jews, but the Jews began to start killing themselves, each other. Because there were so many disputes over whether to fight Rome or not. Some of them wanted to be Hellenized, which was coming from Rome. They wanted all the stuff that Rome was bringing them. And some of them were not, and they were fighting against each other. I've read a couple accounts that it said more Jews were killed by their brothers than by Rome. I find that a little hard to believe, because 1 million is a lot of people. But that's what some of the accounts say. The siege against Rome, against Jerusalem, was so bad under Titus. Oh, I wish I could show this film. There's a film out that shows this siege that comes on. So bad that for so long they didn't have food and they began to eat one another. So we know that cannibalism happened during this time. And then finally, in 70, so this started in 66, and finally in 70, Titus destroyed the temple. And we have the second temple destroyed in 70 AD. And then it is later that Hadrian marches in and actually devastates all of Israel, destroying the country and scattering the Jews. That is what is described in 11:1-3. It is the devastation that Hadrian makes of the countryside. So now, 4-14. Somebody read that, and quickly.
This is what the Lord my God says. Go and care for the flock that is intended for slaughter. The buyers slaughter their sheep without remorse. The sellers say, praise the Lord, now I'm rich. Even the shepherds have no compassion for them. Likewise, I will no longer have pity on the people of the land, says the Lord. I will let them fall into each other's hands and into the hands of their king. They will turn the land into a wilderness, and I will not rescue them. So I cared for the flock intended for slaughter, the flock that was oppressed. Then I took two shepherd's staffs and named one favor and the other union. I got rid of their three evil shepherds in a single month. But I became impatient with these sheep, and they hated me too. So I told them, I won't be your shepherd any longer. If you die, you die. If you are killed, you are killed. And let those who remain devour each other. Then I took my staff, called favor, and cut it in two, showing that I had revoked the covenant I had made with all the nations. That was the end of my covenant with them. The suffering flock was watching me, and they knew that the Lord was speaking through my actions. And I said to them, if you like, give me my wages, whatever I am worth, but only if you want to. So they counted out my wages, 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, this magnificent sum at which they valued me. So I took 30 coins and threw them to the potter in the temple of the Lord. Then I took my other staff, Union, and cut it in two, showing that the bond of unity between Judah and Israel was broken.
Okay. Remember, Zechariah is now acting out his prophecy. It's a prophecy. This is going to happen, but I'm going to live it. Just like Hosea did with Gomer, right? It wasn't just a one-time, like, I'm going to put on a play for you, and it's going to look like this. He actually lives this, and he becomes a shepherd. He becomes a leader of them. So that's what God is calling him to do. He becomes a good shepherd, a faithful leader. We know that God is already saying, you're going to be devastated, 1-4. And this is why you're going to be devastated. Because I'm going to bring you a leader, a good leader, and you're going to reject him. And in rejecting a good leader, what always happens when you reject a good leader? You receive a bad leader. You choose a bad leader. This has been happening over and over again throughout history. And God is saying, these are just little pieces to show you what will happen. And so Zechariah actually becomes one of their leaders. And in leadership, when we're talking about leadership of Israel, it's always, right, the priests are supposed to be leading, the prophets are supposed to be leading, by telling them what God says. And so Zechariah is telling them what God says. Be loyal to me. I'm the good shepherd. Be loyal to me. We have at the beginning there that someone is buying them, buying the people of Israel, and slaying them. Well, we know that's Rome, right? Rome bought them. And they're slaying them. And Rome is going unpunished right now. But we also see that somebody is selling the people. Who's selling them?
They're false leaders.
Priests? They're false leaders. They're selling them. How are they selling them? Because they're loyal to Rome, which means they're more concerned about making sure they have their position than teaching them be loyal to God. Right? I can't say, oh, be loyal to God, when my loyalty is to Rome. When my loyalty is to power that will keep me in power. When my loyalty is really to myself, I cannot be a faithful leader. Right? If the whole purpose of me leading
is to make money off of
to make money off of something or to make status or to give me power, right? I can't be a good leader. That's what's happening. So they are selling their own people so for their own benefit, right? Their own shepherds have no pity on them. The leaders, in other words, not only are they selling them off, they're not pitying them. They're not actually teaching them the spiritual truth about God, who God is, what he's doing. And he says, this is going to happen to you. You are going to have leaders that will do this. They won't teach you that. They'll become fat and rich at the expense of the poor people. They're more concerned about keeping their own positions than leading and teaching the faithfulness to God. So, therefore, then they all are acting like they don't have leaders and they're wandering and they're not being faithful to God because they don't even know how to do it. Think about, then, how Jesus treats the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now you go, oh, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were teaching only what would keep them in power. Mm-hmm. So the rules that they were so adamant about were all about the money that would come from to us as leaders. They weren't teaching them, go out and be good to the poor. Go out and be what Jesus was doing, right? So now you understand this angst between Jesus and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And there's, the more history you know, the more you understand what's going on in those areas there. So God says, I'm going to no longer pity you. You're not being loyal. You don't have leaders and you're not trying to figure it out for yourselves. And he says, you're going to end up killing one another, which I told you, that's what happens, right? When Rome comes, they actually start killing one another. The divisions within the people create all of these deaths. And it says, you will fall into the power of another nation's king, Rome, all the Caesars. They had their own king, but they rejected him and chose Caesar as their king. First secretly, and then just outright in 33 AD. And that king that you pledge allegiance to will strike the land. Hadrian strikes the land completely. They put themselves into all of the Caesar's service, and the Caesars systematically destroyed them and threw them out. That will always happen with false shepherds. That will always happen with shepherds. They're not loyal to the king. They killed the real king, the true shepherd, to avoid a Roman takeover. We like our little kingdoms, they say. We don't want to upset Rome so that they get taken away, so we won't sacrifice for the bigger, greater kingdom of God. That's what's happening here with the shepherds and then the people. So in 7 and 8, Zechariah actually cares for the flock, and he actually teaches them and leads them to what is good. He's trying to teach them, and he's also playing a part that's foreshadowing the real shepherd. And we know, because we know John 10 well enough, we know that he's talking about the good shepherd, and that is Jesus. He is prophesying, this is what the king is going to look like, a shepherd who teaches, who leads. And so he takes his two staffs. And so most shepherds would have had two staffs, right? That's why I went to Psalm 23, right? Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me, right? So we have a rod, right? Straight and thick. And we have a staff with a hook. It was nice we had a big windstorm. favor. Favor, then, is the rod that is this. It's the rod. Why favor? Because I'm going to protect you by beating off the wolves. And that's what I will do as a shepherd. I will beat off the wolves that are trying to eat you, right? That's what a good shepherd would do. That's what Zechariah was trying to do by teaching them. These are false leaders. They're trying to eat you. I'm going to try to beat them. That's the favor, right? Union is a staff that does this. Oh, you're going away. Come back. That's what a staff does. A staff brings you back to the fold, right? I want to bring you back. It helps anybody who's gone astray. And so in his teaching, Zechariah is trying to say, beware the wolves. I'm beating them back. They're wrong. They're false. The New Testament tells us all the time, beware of false teachers, right? Beat them away and then bring in the flock. Tell them what is true, what is loyalty. And so those are the two staffs that he takes to teach them. Always, it's judgment and redemption. Those are the two staffs, right? Judgment and redemption. Zechariah is against three shepherds here. Man, you could read 3,000 different interpretations of who the three shepherds are. My own thought is, I think it's the three levels of leadership. It's high priests in Jesus' time, right? High priests, Pharisees, and Sadducees. High priests, elders would have been the Sadducees, and the scribes would have been the Pharisees. You know, Pharisees weren't official, right? They were just lawyers. So I think that's what they're talking about. Zechariah doesn't get along with, but he has specific three leaders that he doesn't get along with because they are eating the flock, right? And he doesn't get along with them. He's impatient with them, and so he gets rid of them. Bad translation, annihilate. It does not mean to kill. He's just like, go away. I'm sick and tired of you. I'm impatient with you. I need for you. The word actually means to hide or to kick. Go, get away. He was short with them. Well, what kind of a relationship did Jesus have with the Pharisees and the exactly that, right? He's short with them. He says, enough. John calls them vipers, and Jesus actually will call them that later. You're vipers. You need to be beaten with a stick, and you need to get away. So that's what's happening in 4 through 8 here. 9 through 14, we actually have this portrayal of them rejecting the shepherd. So they're actually going to reject Zechariah as a leader. He gives up on those who won't follow, who won't be cared for, who won't listen to his teaching of, let's be loyal to God, this is what God is doing, be vulnerable and open to his invitation. And he says, I'm going to let you eat one another. And we actually know that happens, right? That they actually do have cannibalism. They eat one another. And so he takes favor, the one where I'm bringing you all in, and I'm not going to break because I don't have a second one. He breaks that in half. And so he says, I am no longer, oh, favor. Sorry, favor is the stick. I am no longer going to beat off the wolves for you. I'm not going to protect you that way. I'm going to protect you, but I'm going to protect you by letting the wolves eat you. We do that with our kids sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. I think less now than, I'm reading a book right now that's talking about how less we do it now than we did in former generations. But we let our kids reap some of the consequences, and that's what he's saying. I'm not going to protect you any longer by beating the wolves off. So he breaks that in half. But then it says that the poor of the flock actually recognize that it's God's words. They realize this is the shepherd that God is sending us. And in fact, they seem to have been the poor, the afflicted, the ones who have no stake in this. They're the ones who are listening to Zechariah as he speaks. So there is this small remnant that's listening to Zechariah. When we talk about Zechariah portraying Jesus, who were the people, who were the poor that were listening to Jesus? Do you know how the church starts? It starts with what? Fishermen, right? It starts with poor. And then it grows. And if you do any study about the history of the church, it's poor people. Very few, Paul says this, right? Very few of you were rich. Very few of you were wise. Very few of you
were... Well, even today, that's where the church is growing.
That's where the church is always growing. The church will always grow where it is not full of power, right? In fact, what do we see right now, not just in America, but in Chicagoland? We've had two of the most powerful pastors fall. Why? Unfortunately, I personally know this because they were corrupt with power.
Shepherds he throws out, and you know, when you're talking about what you think, could even, you know, it's interesting how history just keeps repeating, right? I mean, it's just so scary.
Yep.
We just never learn.
Yep.
Fundamental human condition.
It is a fundamental condition, but God said, would you read my word? Would you look out for these? Here's what a false shepherd looks like. He's going to promise you to
can protect your position. What are you to look for? Someone who's humble. Someone who says, let's go feed the poor. Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. That looks really different, right?
Right.
So yes, all of this is, yes, is there a purpose for us reading Zechariah and the prophecies about history that happened? Yes, because it's a big warning for us about what do we look for in a leader. A leader not just in our big country-wise, but a leader in our communities, in our churches, mm-hmm. in our social atmospheres, and a leader in our home, us. As we lead, are we leading? Mm-hmm. Are we have loyalty to what will keep my position in my home, in my community, mm-hmm. In the social atmosphere, all of that? Mm-hmm. This comes from knowing what's happening here in Zechariah 11. So we get to the point where he says, I'm done. And I'm leaving. And if you want to pay me what I'm worth, go ahead. If not, fine, I'm just walking away. And so, of course, what do they decide he's worth?
30 shekels.
What?
30 shekels.
30 shekels. And what is 30 shekels? What do we know 30 shekels is?
A gorged slave.
A gorged slave. A damaged slave. Two things here, right? You are no more worth, you're not worth just a slave. You're just worth a gorged slave, a useless slave. You were a slave to us. And now you're damaged, it was good when you were a slave, because maybe you were doing what we wanted you to, but now you're a gourd slave, and you're no longer any useful to us, right? So we're only going to pay you 30 shekels. And so, of course, we know that this is another prophecy of Jesus, because it happens to Jesus, right?
Yep.
We know that Judas talks about this. And so this is actually happening to Zechariah. Zechariah was a leader. He was a prophet. He kept telling them that. And they devalue him. They give him 30 shekels, and he throws it right to the potter, which is exactly what we have Jesus doing. But I want us to read two passages so we understand not only that Jesus knew that this was happening to him and it happens to him, but what happens to Zechariah. So somebody look up Matthew 23, 31 through 39. And then somebody else look up Matthew 27, 3 through 10. Matthew 23, 31 through 39. And you got it? Quickly.
You want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Okay. So you testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who
This is Jesus talking to them. Go ahead.
That you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. So that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left you desolate. For I say to you, from now on you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. What happens literally to Zechariah?
Mm-hmm.
He gets murdered. Mm-hmm. He gets murdered in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens to this Zechariah that we're talking about when he became leader and they refused him. And remember, his life was a prophecy, was an incarnate prophecy of Jesus. Jesus says, right here, and then right after that, Matthew 27, 3 through 10.
Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to see? Or what is that to us? See to that yourself. And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed. And he went away and hanged himself.
Mm-hmm.
The chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." And they conferred together, and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me.
So you see that Zechariah was playing out Jesus' life, and Jesus knew it. Zechariah gets killed because they don't want a good shepherd. They don't want a shepherd who actually calls them to a kingdom where they're not king. That's what's happened to Israel. That's what he says, Zechariah says to them, this is going to happen to you because you're going to start following not the good shepherd. You're going to reject the good shepherd, and you're going to receive now in 15 through 16 a false shepherd. And the Lord said to me, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So he says to Zechariah, now go and take the equipment of a false shepherd. Behold, I'm going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hoofs. Jesus said this would happen, right? In John 5, he says, I'm come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. But someone's going to come in their own name, and you're going to receive him. This is going to happen. This happened over and over again for Israel. The false shepherd's character, he says, is foolish. And what is it? The New Testament tells us that a fool says in his heart, there is no God. I'm God. I'm king. That's what a foolish shepherd says. The false shepherd's work, everything that is opposed to a real shepherd's work, right? Seeking the lost. He doesn't care for the perishing. He doesn't seek the lost. He doesn't seek scattered. He doesn't heal. He doesn't feed the strong. Which should put in context to you John's question to Jesus when he was in prison and he sends his disciples to Jesus and says, are you the one who is to come? You know what John's doing there? He's making sure that he's not following a false shepherd. Mm-hmm. He's saying, are you the one to come? And what does Jesus say to him? What am I doing? I'm healing the lost. I'm seeking the lost. I'm healing. I'm seeking the scattered. I'm feeding. He answers him from Zechariah. He says, I am the true shepherd to John. John absolutely knows scripture. That's what he wanted to make sure. John's just making sure. I don't want to be following a false shepherd. And God has already told us through Zechariah how not to follow a false shepherd. I just want to make sure, Jesus, that you're not a false shepherd. This is a good thing on John's part, right? It's not so much doubt. It is, I want to make sure I am not following a false shepherd. That's what's happening there. A false shepherd not only does what only satisfies him, so he eats his own flock, the ones who are fat, he kills them in order to fill himself up rather than feed them, but then he tears off their hooves. You know what this means? This is like, I don't like ribs, but you know when people eat ribs and they just want to get every last morsel, what do? Ah, they just like tear up on the bones. That's what he's talking about. Is these leaders will not leave anything that they can't take advantage of from their flock. These leaders are all about getting as much out of their flock for themselves as they can. But the false shepherd will have judgment. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. Woe is always about curse, right? God will curse. God will judge that. Each false shepherd that comes must be judged because he does violence to the order of flourishing. This shepherd, again, it's little pieces. This happens. There's false shepherds. New Testament tells us over and over again, there will be many, many, many. They call them antichrists, right? Antichrist is just anti-king, anti-shepherd. So I don't like to use the word antichrist because we have all these connotations that are a little bit wild. He's really just talking about a false shepherd, a faithless shepherd. His power and his insight will be destroyed. That's what he's talking about when his right arm is power, his right eye is wisdom. That will totally wither and go away. That will be his judgment. He will be completely lost. we could talk about, and I don't want to get into this, but Daniel's prophecy, and I've given you some of the verses, talks about this false shepherd. So there will be many false shepherds, but then there will be one at the very end, that battle, where God will actually do away with that. I want to really quickly get to application, because I think this is important. We need to tend to history. I don't care if you like history or not. If you don't tend to history, you will repeat history. We need to tend, first of all, to review prophetic history, because it tells us that God is moving. He is moving toward his telos of Sabbath. Because it tells us how God is moving toward his telos. These ways. Through his loyal actions, which will involve judgment. It will expose and remove disloyalties. And that will involve deliverance and regathering of his people. Those who are poor, those who are afflicted, those who actually are humble enough, vulnerable enough to participate in his life and let him lead. So we need to know prophetic history. But we also need to know past history. Because past history affirms the accuracy of prophetic history. As you've just seen, I've given you, and I didn't give you all the markings, did I? Where's my marker? Here it is. We know that the oracle talked about all these times, but the oracle also talked about in 11:1-4, Titus destroying the temple. It talked about Hadrian destroying all of the land. It talked about the regathering here that starts 1923, really picks up in 1948 and continues on to today. But it also talked about the second coming as well, when all of that will come too. That's prophetic history. But if I only know prophetic history and I don't know the history of the world, I heard more people say, this was so hard to read. But if you know history, you read it and go, oh my goodness, that's exactly what Alexander did. Oh, that's... Do you understand why history is so important? I would recommend this week to just dive into one of those places. You will be fascinated with how much God has already told us will happen. And then it all has to do with what he's doing, where God is moving. So
where
we need
exactly
to
exactly do you dive into that? Yeah. I'm just not sure.
Just start looking at, just ask a question. Who was in charge of Israel in, 63, or
okay.
Just any kind of question. Just, Google Hadrian, and it'll tell you all the things he devastated. Okay. Google any of, Alexander, Google all of that stuff, and you, treasure troves of things that come up. This is basic. You need to know this basic. You need to know Persia and Greece and Rome and all the things that happened, because all of the things that happen in history, all of the things that happen are God moving. It's God moving. Mm-hmm. Don't think that that's separate and that history doesn't have anything to do with it. So we need to know past history. It encourages us to be faithful. It reminds us that judgment and deliverance will continue to be a part of the process, but it'll just get bigger and bigger. We also need to know present history, our history right now, because it gives us opportunity to participate as loyal subjects of only one king. It keeps us from getting sucked into loyalty to false shepherds. And when I say that, I mean that on all three levels. I mean that on the world political level. I mean that on the social level. Our structures and our communities, which means our churches. And I mean that on the personal level. We get sucked in to false leaders because they promise to uphold our positions. Mm-hmm. Whatever position it might be, whatever is most dear to your heart, you will get sucked into a leader who promises to uphold that. Mm-hmm. And you can take that as a rubric and look at your political leaders, you can look at your social leaders, your church leaders, and you can look at your home leaders. And you can see where your loyalties are because of the kind of leader that you've chosen to ally yourself with, which is exactly what happened with Israel, which is why we need to know what happened with Israel. It motivates us then to impact society. We as the church are here to be like Jamie Smith always says, to be like a meteor that just crashes into all of our society, just says, there's another way to live. We don't have to live always being allied. You know, I think it's funny, and I get a little bit irritated when Christians are so nationalistic, because it says to me, what's your first loyalty? Mm-hmm. Our first loyalty is God the King. Mm-hmm. And that should inform all of what we do, right? Mm-hmm. All of what we do. We should be giving a foretaste of living under a good shepherd who cares for us, who lives for us. We should be inviting vulnerable participation in that, finding blessing to rightly rule. So it keeps us from getting sucked into loyalty to false shepherds, knowing present history. It motivates us to impact society. It keeps us alert to any habits, our personal habits, our social habits, our structural habits, that either prop up a false shepherd, one that's loyal to self, or excuses us from caring the vulnerable, rationalizing care for ourselves before care for others. And it keeps us alert to practicing habits that support and incubate communities loyal to one king. Oh, there's so many things I just want to... we're blessed to be a blessing. So when I say it motivates us to support communities, not communities that close themselves in, not communities that say we've got to have a nice place that's safe. Mm-mm. A community that builds us up to loyalty to the king so that we're sent out, so that we go out and affect history. And we need to know future history. What's the future history? The telos of God. That God will bring about that final battle that brings his rule into being. That the fact that he's going to recapitulate all powers into his power to be right authority, that means that there's necessarily going to be closing of doors on any allegiance to anybody other than the king. If we know the end, it helps us not to cling to power and authority for our own sake. I know the end, that I'm not going to have that authority. I'm going to have right authority only when I'm under the king. So we need to take judgment seriously. We can't allow false shepherds to lead us believing that God doesn't judge. Yes, hard. But I want God to judge. I don't want to live in a kingdom where everyone can't flourish. I already live in that kind of kingdom. I want to live in the kingdom that he has produced. Pride will be reckoned with. Pride always leads to propping up leaders who promise to prop up my position. So it isn't benign. It doesn't just hurt you. It grows into relationships and societies and systems. Pride needs to be exposed because it exposes where your loyalties are. Lastly, don't despise small beginnings. God will raise up the afflicted and the poor, the ones who are humble, the ones who are vulnerable, the ones who are small. Not the giants, not the megas, but those who listen and are willing to come under the king and let him do what he intends to do. Father, you have given us so much. Father, I pray that we will be students of history, because being students of history means being students of your story. Being students who see that you are moving in everything that's happening. Father, I pray that we would not close our eyes to that, but that we would be enthralled with being faithful to you and looking to not reject your good leadership. Father, may we continue to go out and give tastes of your good leadership, your good care, you caring for us as a good shepherd. In Jesus' name, amen.